Today we're going to continue our series, Hero Maker. Today we're in part 5. If you have your Bible with you, we're going to be in 1 Kings chapter 12. If you don't have one with you, you can use the one in the row that you're in. That's our gift to you. If you'd like to take that with you, or as always, you can follow along online at bcnazarene.org/gatherings. And the passage that we're going to look at today is one of those passages in Scripture that doesn't necessitate that it be found within the pages of Scripture. And as you'll see, this account that we're going to look at, it could be found anywhere. And it is found everywhere. And I hope you'll see something that's really common to the world that we live in today. I think it's interesting that sometimes people comment like, oh, it's hard to read the Bible because it's hard to understand. It's just difficult to understand. And I understand that sentiment. I get it. But here's the thing that I just think is interesting within that. Because I don't know how many of you, like in high school or college, had to read a work of literature that was translated from a different language and took place in a different culture. How many of you had to read something from the early 20th century or from the 1800s or something like that? And you go, oh, it's like, it's clunky, it's a little bit off. And it's like, that's a recent thing. And so we are opening a book, we're opening these accounts that the most recent one was 2,000 years ago, written in a different language, halfway across the world. And so I think the amazing thing is that any of it makes sense to us, is that any of it is understandable. But I think the important piece within there is it makes me really aware of how much in our world that changes so quickly, the things that actually never change and the things that stay constant. And so that's the passage that we're going to look at today. And so the title of the message, I want to give it to you up on the front end. The title of the message today is Not Like This. Would you turn to your neighbor and please say, Not Like This. So this is 1 Kings chapter 12, and today we're going to look at the story of Rehoboam, which is the most fun word in the world to say. Rehoboam, band name called it. 1 Kings chapter 12, here we go. Rehoboam went to Shechem, where all Israel had gathered to make him king. When Jeroboam, son of Nebat, heard of this, he returned from Egypt, for he had fled to Egypt to escape from King Solomon. The leaders of Israel summoned him, and Jeroboam and the whole assembly of Israel went to speak with Rehoboam. So I'll pause right there. There's a narrative that you can quickly piece together if you're paying attention to the clues. And so we have Rehoboam, whose father was Solomon, who has taken the kingship from his father Solomon when he passed away. Solomon obviously had a disagreement, which we're going to figure out what that disagreement is in just a second, with this guy by the name of Jeroboam. And so when Solomon passes away and Rehoboam becomes king, then Jeroboam returns to see if they can settle their differences. That was impressive. That was like a tongue twister with all the Rehoboams and Jeroboams, and I executed that flawlessly. So, thank you. We'll keep going. Went to speak with Rehoboam. Verse 4, your father was a hard master, they said. Lighten the harsh labor demands and heavy taxes that your father imposed on us, then we will be your loyal subjects. Rehoboam replied, give me 3 days to think this over, then come back for my answer. So the people went away. Then King Rehoboam discussed the matter with the older men who had counseled his father, Solomon. What is your advice? He asked. How should I answer these people? The older counselors replied, if you are willing to be a servant to these people today and give them a favorable answer, they will always be your loyal subjects. But Rehoboam rejected the advice of the older men and instead asked the opinion of the young men who had grown up with him and were now his advisors. Pause right there real quick. We all do that, just so we're aware. Like, we don't call them our advisors, right? Like, no one's like, what are you doing tonight? I'm going to go hang out with my advisors. But our advisors inevitably become the people who we hang out with the most and the people who we choose to spend the most time with. And so this is not, should not be seen as like, oh, that's a weird decision, because every single one of us does that over and over again. So, what verse are we on? 8. Apologies. But Rehoboam rejected the advice of the older men and instead asked the opinion of the young men who had grown up with him and were now his advisors. What is your advice, he asked them. How should I answer these people who want me to lighten the burdens imposed by my father? The young men replied, this is what you should tell those complainers
Who want a lighter burden? My little finger is thicker than my father's waist. Which, like, we get what he's saying, but isn't that the weirdest way possible to say it? Like, let's think of the most confusing metaphor we could use, and let's use that. My little finger is thicker than my father's waist. Yes, my father laid heavy burdens on you, but I'm going to make them even heavier. My father beat you with whips, but I will beat you with scorpions. Yikes. 3 days later, Jeroboam and all the people returned to hear Rehoboam's decision, just as the king had ordered. But Rehoboam spoke harshly to the people, for he rejected the advice of the older counselors and followed the counsel of his younger advisors. He told the people, "My father laid heavy burdens on you, but I'm going to make them even heavier. My father beat you with whips, but I will beat you with scorpions." So the king paid no attention to the people. This turn of events was the will of the Lord, for it fulfilled the Lord's message to Jeroboam, son of Nebat, through the prophet Ahijah from Shiloh. Pause right quick there. There's a bunch of names that don't really make sense, and we're not going to give the backstory in terms of the context of this. But I want to say this, just so we're not thrown off. When it says this turn of events was the will of the Lord, should not be interpreted as Rehoboam had no decision. It was destined that he was going to choose this because it was the will of the Lord. That's not what it's saying, okay? What it's saying here is that God continues to work through our ignorance and idiocy, whether we're aware of it or not. Okay? Does that make sense? Like, it's not like I just had no choice. And it's like it's the same thing for us. You can't make a dumb decision, have the consequences play out before you, and then be like, God's will. What am I going to do? It's God continues to work even if we're aware of it or not. So it was the will of the Lord. Verse 16. When all Israel realized that the king had refused to listen to them, they responded, "Down with the dynasty of David. We have no interest in the son of Jesse. Back to your homes, O Israel. Look out for your own house, O David." So the people of Israel returned home. I think it's interesting as we look at this passage, again, the ways in which it's obvious. The ways in which that, like, we read the story and we don't have to exert any mental energy to imagine ourselves within the narrative of this story, of this account. We don't have to be like, oh, I wonder what that was like, because we live it out over and over again, do we not? Like, this is really common. This is really obvious. Like, Rehoboam's story is all of our story. We all struggle with it. We all go through it. We've all faced it in some way. And it's interesting as we look at this to see what is unchanging in terms of our culture and the way in which we live. And so what's the problem? What's the deal? And we go, obviously it's Rehoboam, right? If Rehoboam would have just listened, if he would have just done differently, then he wouldn't have split this kingdom apart. Everyone would have been better for it if Rehoboam would have been better. And so this is where some of our cultural criticisms begin to fail and fade away. So it's Rehoboam. He's just too young, right? Those biblical millennials. Rehoboam in his Snapchat, Fortnite. Maybe if Rehoboam didn't spend so much time on social media, maybe things would have turned out differently if he could just talk face to face instead of digitally communicating to everyone around him. Maybe he would have been wiser. And yet we find ourselves in a completely different scenario, and yet the same outcome. And so maybe our criticisms of the world today, not saying that all those things are helpful, I'm not saying that I really believe Fortnite is giving us a stronger society and a more stable culture as a whole. That's not the message. But maybe that's not the problem. Maybe it's actually something deeper. Maybe it's something more significant than that. And this is where I would at least like for us to begin this discussion today. Is this idea of what if we did something different? What if Rehoboam's story and the story of the nation of Israel being split into two, what if that wasn't our story? What if we just on the front end, what if we were initially able to just commit to that, to go, his story will not be ours. We will not let it turn out like this. Not like this. That's not who we're going to become. That's not who we're going to be.
because I find myself in positions and places that, I'll just say it bluntly like this, I am so tired of all the division. And I meant that metaphorically, but I mean that mathematically as well. There's nothing about division that excites me mathematically while we're here. But I'm so tired of all the division. And I got on Twitter after like a 9-month exit from Twitter, and I left because I felt like people were just fighting, that it was just this eternal argument on Twitter. And I got back on after 9 months, and it was like coming back home and everything's the same. It was like, oh, Twitter's still fighting. New argument, been gone 9 months. And I just kind of prep myself for any time there is a significant issue in our culture. I'm just going to stay off Facebook that week. Because I go on Facebook for hilarious memes and cute pictures of your children. That's it. I don't need the protest. I don't need the argument. I hear enough of that. I don't need that as part of my life. And I just get sick of it. I'll just be honest with you. I just get sick of it. And the ways in which it is so easy for us to become divided culturally, the ways in which it is so easy for us to become divided racially, in the context of this passage, the ways in which it is so easy for us to become divided based upon age and understanding of history and background and culture, and to simply go at the end of the day, hey, could we not be like that? Could that not be us? Could we find some unity in the understanding that we don't want that to be our story? We don't want our lives to turn out like this. And so then the question becomes immediately within it. We go, okay, we always have to ask this question. When something is wrong, we must ask, who is at fault? So who's responsible? Whose problem is it? Who's really at fault here? And the answer initially is obvious. It's Rehoboam. Like, Rehoboam is at fault. Rehoboam is responsible. Could we acknowledge that all on the same page? Even though he's younger, because of his Fortnite, I assume, naturally. Rehoboam is the one at fault. He should have listened. He should have known better. He should have not sought in the moment to expand his own influence and authority. He should have had the knowledge and the ability to serve those around him. So Rehoboam is at fault. But this is important. Just because Rehoboam is at fault, just because Rehoboam is the one who is responsible, doesn't mean that other people couldn't have done something to make it better. Just because Rehoboam is responsible in this moment doesn't mean that other people don't have a part to play. I'm not seeking to absolve Rehoboam of his responsibility, but rather help us see the creative and important ways in which we can make it better even when we're not responsible. And we see two things that are really, really important. The first one is this, is the older advisors who come to Rehoboam give Rehoboam advice that they did not live out themselves. You see, the reason why Jeroboam left and it was already this difficulty within the kingdom is because the advisors of Solomon had told him about the harsh demands and the labors and the taxes that they should put people through in order to build Solomon's temple and these other significant things that were amazing but had a heavy tax and toll on the people. And so Solomon's advisors have been telling him for years, and then all of a sudden, when Rehoboam becomes king, they say, oh no, you need to scale it back, which is this massive understanding of, we say it like this, hey, do as I say, not as I do. And that doesn't work. Like, I don't know what teenager in the world has ever, like, to heard their parent, like, hey, do as I say, not as I do. Like, sure. Sounds great. I will learn the wisdom from the path that you have walked before me, mom and dad. Thank you for these lessons that you have learned to spare me of pain and difficulty. Has any of your kids said that? You know how I know none of your kids said that? Because none of you ever said that to your parents. Like, your parents shared those things and we all did the same thing. We said, well, you turned out all right. You're still alive, so I can do dumb stuff too, right? It's idiotic, but that's how our brains work. And so the first failure that his advisors have is that they say, do as I say, not as I do, and it's only modeling that actually makes a difference, not the lessons that we teach in the moment. But then there's another piece of this that I think is extremely important, is that these older advisors are described as Rehoboam's father's advisors. They're not his. They're his father's advisors. There is no relationship there. There's no communication. There's no care there. because they're his father's advisors. And I wonder often within this, within the biblical story on the front end of going, man, what would have been different if his father's advisors would have taken the time to get to know and care about Rehoboam? What if they were no longer simply his father's advisors, but they were actually his friends in that same moment? And let's see the parallel to today. How often do we find ourselves in spots in which something is going wrong, in which something is off, and we would rather just yell than help? We would rather tell everyone what they're doing wrong than actually get close enough to care and close enough to make a difference. Can I tell you what doesn't work? Just so we're all on the same page. Sitting back on your computer or back wherever you want to be and then going, I told them. No one has ever in their life been like, thank you. Thank you for yelling, I told them. It made all the difference in the world. I'm better because of it. I did this the other day. My kids were playing soccer. My kids were attempting to play soccer. And my oldest, she's out on the field and she's running around. She was not where she's supposed to be. And the ball, I could tell it was going to come. It was going to come where she was. And so I yelled at her. I was like, Maddie, run forward. And she was going to be right in a spot where she could have taken a shot at the goal. And so right as I yell, Maddie, run forward, she turns around and looks at me. And the ball went right behind her. Nailed it. Way to go, Dad. Made it so much better. And I think it's easy for us to find ourselves in that spot where we're just yelling, we're protesting, we're saying what's wrong, and we're not actually helping in this moment. And so maybe we could be different. Maybe we could be better. Maybe we could say, even though I'm not responsible in the moment, I still have a part to play to make it better. Within the division, within the struggle, within the circumstances that aren't going how they should, I may not be solely responsible, but rather than blame, we can do something different. And so where's that begin? Well, this is how I explain it with my kids. Yesterday, my wife was gone the majority of the day. She was out working, and so I had all four kids. I was not babysitting, because I'm a dad, so I was dadding, okay, with all four kids. And we were just kind of like the countdown clock. We're just like, get through the day. That's in the mode that we were in. We're like, just survive till mom gets home. Everyone stay alive. That's what we're seeking to do. And there was this like circumstance that came out with my kids where they were just like fighting and they were arguing and they were yelling and they were kind of hitting each other and slightly pulling hair. And one of them was attempting to bite the young one he was attempting to bite. And there was no like issue. There was no like conflict resolution that I could do in that moment. They were just fighting. They were just mad at each other in general. You know, parents, like that situation that makes you crazy where they're just like mad, so they're gonna be mad. It's the situation that makes parents crazy, and it's the situation that makes people without kids never want to have kids. Yeah, you know how that is. It's like, why would we want to have kids? You used to be happy. Why do you want me to be you? And so we're just going through that, and they're like fighting over a blanket because this blanket was the softest, and there was only one of them, and one of them had it first, and they couldn't all have the blanket. It made me just like want to take the blanket and rub it in the mud outside and be like, who wants it now? But I didn't do that because I have self-control. And so we're just going through that, and at the end, I just like separated, and I'm like, no one gets the blanket, no one do this. And I looked at my oldest, Maddie, and I said, Maddie, I need you to go, I need you to sit in this chair, I need you not talk to anyone or touch anyone. And she goes, but that's not fair. And I learned from my friend Becky Brown that fair is where the pigs win ribbons. I told Maddie that, and it didn't mean anything to her. What? Felt good to say. And so we just went through that whole situation, and it set Maddie over, and she's sitting in her chair. And in this moment, she hadn't done anything wrong. She hadn't done anything wrong. She hadn't done anything to incite the problem. She was really being good. And she'd go, why am I sitting here? And I told her this. I said, because you're the most mature. That's why I need you to do that. And she did, and the problem was resolved. And so here's this message today. This message is not to the one who's responsible. It's to the person who is sick of division and sick of infighting, sick of things not going how they can be. And this message is to the most mature. All of those of you who are immature, you can discount yourselves. I'm no longer talking to you. But for the one who's mature, the one who's saying, I may not be responsible, but I can make it better, this is what I want to jump into. Is what if the older advisors, what if the younger advisors, what if Rehoboam himself would have taken the advice of the older advisors? Because there's a key piece in their advice that I think is where Rehoboam turned away, but is so incredibly important. This is what they tell him in verse 7, 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 7. It says, the older counselors replied, if you are willing to be a servant, if you're willing to be a servant today. Now, they themselves were not willing to be a servant, but that was the key. You go, Rehoboam, you can't be the servant. I'm king. I tell people what to do. No, no, if you're willing to be a servant, it's so important. Another translation, I love this as an idea for service. It doesn't translate as if you're willing to be a servant. It translates it like this. If you are willing to do good for these people, that's what a servant is. Someone who's willing to do good for someone else instead of being preoccupied with how they can do good for themselves. That's what the nature of a servant is. I'm willing to put my focus on doing good for someone else. If you are willing to be a servant. But that doesn't happen. This is what it says in verse 16. Rehoboam doesn't do it. And it says, when all Israel realized that the king had refused to listen to them, they responded, down with the dynasty of David. We have no interest in the son of Jesse. Back to your homes, O Israel. Look out for your own house, O David. So the people of Israel returned home. When I was in fifth grade, because we had just moved to a new neighborhood, I was attempting to make friends, which I'm not really good at. And I'm grateful for a wife who's the most extroverted, outgoing person I know. But sometimes she makes too many friends. And I'm like, I don't need that many friends. Sometimes I like to be by myself. But I was attempting to make friends. And so I went over, and there were a couple guys in our neighborhood, and we went over to play basketball. And they lowered the hoop, and which was a real problem for me, because I can't jump, could not jump, still cannot jump. And so I went over to these kids' house, and they just dunked on me the entire time. And so I did what any mature person would do. I picked up my ball, which, to be clear, was the only ball that we had. So it was also their ball in that moment. I picked up my ball, and I went home because I didn't care. And that's actually exactly what plays out in this story. As they go, hey, you don't care about us? You're unwilling to do good for us? We have no interest in you. We're going home. And I wonder within this passage, what if they would have lived differently? What if they would have served? You see, I think this is really important. The reality is this, is that you can experience and have God's forgiveness for your sins and yet still not actively participate in His will. You can have God's forgiveness for your sins. You can accept that salvation and still not be actively participating in His will and what He's doing in the world. And the secret is within this phrase, if you are willing to serve. And I think this is a phrase that maybe needs some imagination behind it, because for me, for most of my life, this idea of willing to serve was like, roll over, let people walk all over you, right? That's what serve is. Or serve is just being in the background, doing the grunt jobs, doing the difficult jobs that no one cares about. And I think there are pieces of that that are actually true, that are part of serving, but I don't think that's what serving is at its essence. This is how I've come to understand it, is it is easy for me to get emotional or passionate about things that make me mad. It's easy for me to incite emotion or to become alive at when someone comes in contrast with what is good for me. So you cut me off, I have emotion there in that moment. if you do something to get in front of me, actually, I'll be honest with you, this is a moment of confession. When I say cut me off, that was the safe confession. There is nothing that makes me more crazy in the entire world than being in a store walking behind someone who doesn't know where they're going. Because they just kind of like wander around and I like do this the whole time, like, this way, we're going. Caught! So, like, if you disrupt my time, that for me in that moment, that is like, oh my goodness. And I feel that in that moment because I want to do good for me. But to serve is to have that same level of emotion and passion to do good for others. You see, we do a great job at fighting with people and fighting against people. When their will seems to come into contrast with our will, we do a great job of that. But serving is about learning how to fight well. It's about learning how to fight out of hope and not simply out of anger. It's about learning not how to fight with someone to get your way, but it's learning how to fight for someone in order to do what's best for them. And I think the reality is that for most of us, we've only ever learned how to fight with. We've only ever learned how to fight out of anger or how to fight out of frustration. And we've never learned how to fight out of hope. How to muster all that emotion and all that energy to the things that we think are wrong into the channel of the things that we think are right and the things that we think should happen. And I wonder in this moment if Rehoboam would have learned how to fight well, would have learned like, no, Rehoboam, your role in this moment is not simply to serve your people. It's to fight for your people because they're hanging by a thread. It's to fight for the people who are the citizens of your kingdom because they need hope in this moment. I wonder for us on the same boat. I wonder if more dads understood what it looked like to fight well, to fight for your family, not fight with your family. Moms, if you learned how to fight well, how to do what was best over and over again and have the same energy and emotion at the things that are right. I wonder if young people, instead of just protesting the next thing that you think is wrong, if you learn how to fight for the things that were the most important in the exact same moment and not just when opposition rose up. He says, if you're willing to serve, if you're willing to fight well, and I think one of the reasons why we don't do this is because when we fight against something, we can inflict pain upon it. But when we fight for something, the reality is we will enter into that pain. You see, it's not just that fighting for is harder, it's that it's more painful. I'm gonna take a simple illustration and make it way too spiritual, okay? If I could just acknowledge that on the front end. This past week, while I was working on this message, we had just a dumb thing happening in the office, dumb being ridiculous. And so what happened is our next gen team is going to take a group of students to this camp in Florida next year, which they're all really excited about, and I'm excited about, and who wouldn't be excited about because it's Florida. And so they're all pumped because they're going to take this group to camp in Florida. And as we were going through, one of the people who works in our office was saying that he was only going to take one of his two kids to camp. We're going to keep that person nameless. It was VJ. He's sitting right there. Okay. And so he's talking about how he's only going to take one of his two kids to camp. So Keisha, our next gen lead, she got out this jar and put a picture of his son on it and put it like this Send Jay to Camp Fund, which is just, it was great. I loved every minute of it. I got no work done for that 20 minutes, but it was hilarious. And as we're going through and we're putting like little change in, stuff like that, Haley went back to get her jar of change, which who has a jar of change? Are you 80? What's going on here? We'll talk about that later. So Haley goes back to her office to get her jar of change and she dropped it. It was this glass jar and she dropped it and it shattered everywhere. And so she's going, she's picking it up and she cut herself as she was picking up the pieces. She made the comment earlier, she didn't know if she was an adult. The answer is no, because adults wear gloves. We know that when it comes to glass. And so she picked it up and she cut herself. And I'm working on this message, and this is what I thought of in the moment. As I thought of it, and I told you, I'm going to make this way too spiritual, but I think this is important. The ways in which all of our lives and the lives of those around us are like that jar. And it takes no effort, takes very little effort. It takes no courage to smash the jar. It takes no courage to criticize someone else's life. It takes no effort to throw someone else under the bus. It's not hard. It's not courageous. It's not difficult. Any single one of us could do it. But yet, to bend down and to pick up the pieces of that life is difficult, is hard, and sometimes requires pain. To take someone who is hurting, someone who needs help, someone who needs hope, and to enter into that difficulty requires oftentimes that we take that pain upon ourselves and we can get cut because of it. And so I think the reason why we fight against so often more than we fight for and we fight well is because we don't want to enter into that pain. We don't want to feel that difficulty. And for some reason, I don't understand this, we have accepted the idea that in other arenas of our life that pain is actually important. And we've understood that pain is not simply the boundaries of the limits, but pain is actually the passageway into your greatness. Like, we see this. Like, we talk about sports. No one has ever gone to their coach while playing sports, while they were doing sprints or conditioning, and said, "Coach, my legs are starting to hurt a little bit. I think it's time for me to stop." Like, no one would ever do that. They go, "Run more." Like, that would never happen. No one has ever gone, like, or no parent has allowed this, or teacher has allowed this. Like, "Hey, teacher, I was working on my homework, and this, it got hard, so I think I'm done. I think I'm done with addition. I'm good. I don't need to go any further than that. I think I'm done. It's starting to make my brain hurt a little bit, so let's just call it quits right here." No, we understand that. We understand that pain is the passageway to your greatness, not the boundaries on your limits. And yet for some reason within all that, we've never actually applied it to our faith. And as soon as God leads us in a place that is awkward or uncomfortable, we go, "No thanks, I'm out." As soon as God leads us to a place in which we feel like we are stretched beyond our limits or to do something new that is unfamiliar to us, we go, "No thanks, I'm good." And maybe if anything I could encourage you this morning is to keep going, is to move forward within that, to understand that if you're going to step into that greatness, it requires initially that it be difficult. It requires in moments that it be hard. And don't stop because it hurts. Don't stop because it gets difficult in a moment, because we must become comfortable walking within that pain. I saw an example of this years ago when we moved to Kentucky. You know, when we first moved to Kentucky, I had a guy, he was driving me around in the church that I was serving at. There was this building that was on the further end that was across a gravel parking lot. And so we had driven his truck up to the edge of that gravel parking lot, and then he got out and he was going to walk across to the building. And this is going to sound like a Kentucky joke, and I mean nothing within that, but it's factual, is neither of us were wearing shoes. That's not important to the details of the story, but neither of us were wearing shoes in the moment. And so we get to the edge of the gravel parking lot and he starts walking across. And I just stood there. He's like, "Are you coming?" I was like, "No, that hurts." Because my feet had not been hardened by years of stepping on Legos from my children, which they are now. But he just started walking across it. I was like, "No, it hurts. Why wouldn't we get in the truck and drive across it? Like, I'm not going to walk across the gravel parking lot like that the entire time. And it didn't feel good." I was like, "How are you able to do it?" He goes, "I've been doing this for years." He goes, I bet you I could run across the gravel parking lot faster than you could drive my truck." I was like, "No, no way." And so I got in his truck and he beat me. He beat me. He ran across the gravel parking lot faster than I drove his truck. It wasn't very far, to be clear, but I was amazed. And I got out of there and I was like, "How did you do that?" And he goes, "I'm from Kentucky. I never wear shoes." And this is what he was saying, is that his feet had been hardened from years of walking over it. And so he was used to it. And I don't think we're often used to the pain. And we must become it. We must become used to walking in pain. We must become used to walking in difficulty, that it no longer stands out and seems significant in the moment, but it becomes normal, because this is necessitated if we're going to be able to help those who were called to help. And the reality at the end of the day that I realized from this passage is that the example and lesson from Rehoboam is not enough, because we've seen this story play out for years and we've played out over and over again today. And so the lesson from Rehoboam is not enough. It's actually the power of Jesus that we need in this moment. In Matthew chapter 20, there's this account that could have turned out very similar to Rehoboam. in which one of the moms of two of Jesus' followers come to Jesus, and they ask if they could hear her two sons could sit at his left and his right when he comes in his glory and comes in his power. And so the mom comes in, which all of us just kind of go, "Mom, of course." And so she asks this question. Jesus says, "No, those places have already been prepared." And then it breaks out this fight among all the disciples as to who was going to get those positions and how could someone ask for that position? How could someone want to be that significant? Who gets to be that significant? And this is how Jesus responds. This is one of the passages of scripture that are just etched in my heart and I can never, ever forget. In verse 25, it says, "But Jesus called them together and said, 'You know that the rulers in this world lord it over their people.'" Which I could pause right there and just go, yeah, we know, right? We know. We know so often those who have authority, those who have influence, those who have power, act in a way to expand their authority, influence, and power, and not to do what is best. He says, "You know that the rulers in this world lord it over their people, and officials flaunt their authority over those under them." And then Jesus says this, "But among you, it will be different. Whoever wants to be a leader among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first among you must become your slave. And this is why. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve others and to give his life as ransom for many." Mike, if we could go back to that verse 26, the highlighted piece. "But among you, it will be different." And so, BCN, to those who are mature, this is my call for us. Among us, it must be different. It must be different. We cannot spend our lives obsessing over our preferences. We cannot spend the years we have to make contributions to the kingdom within faith, to worry and focus on what is best for me. He says, among you, it will, it has to be different, or we end up like Rehoboam, and we cannot live that life. And so the reality is this, this has been about a year now in which we have talked about our vision. And if you're unfamiliar with this, we said we want to be someone's first church, not simply someone's next church. We want to, if you have no experience, no background, we want this to be a place for you. And we want to lead you into spiritual maturity of what it looks like to experience the fullness of life of relationship with Jesus, with a significant marker in there of being baptism, which we're going to celebrate in a moment. We said as a church, we want to see 1,041 people baptized in the next 10 years. And in order to do that, it will require as a community in many ways that we become comfortable with pain. And we'll experience it in different ways. Early in next year, we're going to launch our recovery ministry, which I'll share details on over the next couple weeks and months. And as we've had initial discussions on this, one of the things that keeps coming up is people say, "You know, it's going to be messy. You know, it's going to be hard." My response has always been, I will take messy and meaningful over sanitized and insignificant any day of the week. Absolutely. And we'll experience it in significant ways like that. We will also experience it in subtle ways. Last week, we had an issue with our kids' check-in, and our kids' check-in line became longer than Chick-fil-A at 5 p.m. Like, it was everywhere. And within these moments, within every single time, I want you to know you have an opportunity. You have an opportunity to say, "Is this best for me?" You have an opportunity to interpret everything that happens through the circumstances of how is this simply making my life better, or how is this helping or inconveniencing me? Or you have an opportunity to say, "Among me," I know that's grammatically horrible, but stay with me. "Among me, it will be different. Among us, it will be different. It's not about my life. It's about what God is doing through me." We had some friends over to our house on Friday night, some people who we had never hung out with because my wife makes more friends than I have. We'll keep going. So we had some people over. And we didn't ask, we didn't go around and we didn't, Bethany didn't go, Kevin, what do you want to eat? We didn't ask our kids, what do you want to eat? We asked our friends, what do you want to eat? Now, you know what would have been the worst thing in that moment is if she would have gone around to every single person, she would have gone, what do you like? What's your favorite thing? What's your favorite thing? What's your favorite thing? What's your favorite thing? And then we throw it all together and serve it. Because we would have had this weird mix of pizza, taco, chicken nugget, sour cream, salad. And no one would have liked that. And here's the important thing that I want you to hear within that. Is I could walk around and do that and say, what do you like? What do you like? What do you like? What do you like? Which song do you want to sing? And you want to sing? And you want to sing? And which passage do you want me to preach on? And which passage do you want me to preach on? And we'll put it all together. And it'd be terrible. Because the reality is this is a community we will never find unity within our preferences. We can only ever find unity within our purpose. And when we gather together and say, among you, it will be different. And so I want you to know, this. If you're here for the first time, man, this may be a lot if you're new to BCN. But this is what I want you to know, that this community, these people, will serve you in the best way we possibly can. We will love you as much as we possibly can. And we will continue to do that. And there will be a day in which we invite you or you feel the urge or compelled to be a part of it. And on that day, we welcome you not simply into salvation, but into God's mission and what he's doing to redeem the world. So in this moment, I want to do something a little different. And in just a second, we're going to celebrate a baptism. And normally when this happens, we have the kids kind of sneak in during a worship song because we want the kids and students as part of the middle to be a part of what we're celebrating in baptism. And I say sneak in the most sarcastic way possible because there's no way for 80 kids to sneak in anywhere, ever. But we're going to do something different today. So today we're going to invite them in just a second. Oh, you guys standing in the dark corner. Thank you. Doesn't concern me at all. is we're going to welcome them in. And we're not going to do this for them. We're going to do this for us. Because so often our kids are in the back. Not because we want them in the back, but because they learn best in their own environment. We don't put them in the back because it's best for us. We do that because it's best for them. But I think there's times in which it would be easy to communicate that our kids and our students are less significant than what happens in here. So this is what I'm going to ask. This is the kids come in and they're going to take all these seats within here. Can we just cheer for them? Can we just let them know how much we love them? And I want to prep you with this. There's a lot of them, okay? Which is a good reason to be thankful. And I want you to cheer as much for that first kid who walks in as you do for the last. I said that the wrong way, but you understand what I'm saying. And so let's welcome our kids in, who we celebrate.